Hey, and thanks for listening. This is Conversations, the True Voice Media podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Gibbard. Let's get started. Today I've got Robert J. Moore. I think he goes by Bob. I could be wrong. And
you got it.
Nice. Co-founder and I believe president, if I'm not mistaken, of RJ Metrics. And what I'd love to do is let Rob just Bob just introduce himself and tell us a little bit about what he does.
Sure. Yes. Yeah. So you are correct. I'm the CEO over at RJ Metrics. We're a Philadelphia-based hosted business intelligence company. Basically, our vision is to inspire and empower data-driven people. And we do that by building software that helps online businesses make smarter decisions using their data. So we've been at this for a little over 5 years now, but things have really been heating up over the past 2 years or so, where we've raised some financing from some big investors out of the West Coast and also been able to really substantially grow our customer base. And now we're helping hundreds of these online businesses basically use their data to drive the key decisions that allow them to grow faster.
So I'd love to dive into the whole data thing because I think you know a little bit about data and such. So I feel like you're a good person to ask some of these questions I've been having.
Sure.
But just to lay the groundwork first, are you primarily working with e-commerce companies? Are you working with companies across the board? And is the data insights that you're providing primarily geared around increasing sales and things like that? Or does it expand beyond that?
Sure. So e-commerce is definitely our bread and butter, but I'd say that broadly speaking, our customers are anybody who sells anything online. So I would include software as a services businesses in there, online gaming companies, anybody dealing with virtual goods. We have some nonprofits who use us to do donor development. And we certainly do analytics that extend beyond the reach of just driving more sales volume. That's obviously a core area of focus for a lot of these folks, but we also spend a lot of energy on things like merchandising, focusing on marketing ROI. So the expense piece as well as the sales acquisition piece. And then honestly, you know, the part of the beauty of the platform is just its level of flexibility on conducting ad hoc analysis on anything that might matter. So if you're a business that is a community site, for example, and you care about the correlations between certain measures of engagement and that impact on people's likelihood to buy or to buy multiple times or to refer a friend or kick off some other viral effect, all of those things can be studied within the platform. And we're very happy to kind of empower people to do any of those kinds of analyses.
So this is like a custom platform that you can basically plug in all sorts of data and drive insights from?
Yeah, I mean, it's it is absolutely that, in that it's extremely flexible. So in some ways, it's almost like Excel for databases, in that you can pull in data from any number of data sources, be it your back-end databases, your third-party providers, like your email service provider, your customer relationship management system, your customer service platform, get that all under one hood, and then use our tool to combine that data and conduct analyses of how that data interrelates to one another. But that said, there is a lot of stuff right out of the box that we've found to be best practices across people in these industries that we focus on. So we're able to deliver a lot of core analyses automatically prefabricated for everybody the moment they join the platform. And then if they want to expand upon those and go and conduct analyses that are inspired by those, the platform's got the level of flexibility required to deliver that too.
Okay, so here's the first question I have to ask you about all of that. You are the co-founder of this, and is it Jack is your co-founder?
Jake.
Okay, so are you both just like total spreadsheet data nerds that you were like, you know what can we do with this skill of being able to look at spreadsheets and not go blind? Like, how did you come up with this? Or did you just see, hey, you know, data is going to be where the ROI is, data is where the money is, and nobody's really taking this ball and running with it. We have the capability to do it. How did you get here?
Yeah, I mean, you're definitely right about the nerds thing. So Jake and I met as coworkers at a venture capital firm in New York back in 2005, and our job there was very heavily rooted in being able to use Excel really, really, really well. And a lot of the work that I would do at the firm specifically centered around the due diligence process, which is when a venture firm is looking at potentially investing in a company, they'll do a lot of legwork to make sure that, number one, the company's not lying to them, and number two, there aren't really any skeletons in the closet in terms of the core assets of this company and the value of things like the customer base and the likelihood of people coming back and spending more. So in that role, I spent a lot of energy combining analysis that would be done by running SQL queries on databases, pulling that data into Excel, manipulating it, conducting an analysis, putting that analysis out into a PowerPoint presentation and sharing it with the partners of the firm or the portfolio company itself. You go through that process enough times and you realize that there are certain pieces that can be automated. There are very large elements of this that are very frustrating for operating companies, but provide a tremendous amount of value when the end result comes out. So it was one of those moments where we just kind of realized if we don't replace ourselves with a computer, somebody else is going to. And that was kind of the impetus for starting RJ Metrics in the first place. And it really was designed to make life easier for people that wanted to do all that Excel work and do that SQL work, but didn't necessarily have the computer science background or, frankly, the time to do it right.
So did you immediately approach that the venture capital that you were working for and try to sell them on this product?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, there was a point in time where something like 80 or 90% of our revenue was coming from portfolio companies of that venture firm. So, you know, we set out to bootstrap the company from day one rather than raise money at the outset. So we didn't go looking for outside financing on day one, but what we wanted to do was finance the business through revenue. And we had a Rolodex, and that Rolodex was pretty deep with people from this one particular population of companies. So, you know, we were really fortunate to have extremely supportive and influential people as mentors who were our bosses at that firm, Insight Venture Partners. And you know, they've been super supportive, and we were able to help out a lot of portfolio companies there. And, you know, today those companies are far less than 5% of our revenue, but it's still a really important relationship for us. Insight tends to invest in much later stage companies, so they're a lot more likely to write a $100 million check than a $1 million check. So, you know, if we're lucky and we continue to grow, maybe we'll be lucky enough to work with them again down the road. But as of today, they're not investors in the company.
Gotcha. That's awesome. I love that you, you're talking about growing the company through revenue, because that's very much been my approach to growing my businesses. I feel like you do good work and you succeed that way rather than giving up some ownership and stake in the company and potentially sacrificing the big payoff. So I totally dig that.
Cool.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. You started out with these VC companies and providing a service and a platform for them. How much has the platform evolved and changed either through learning or through the changing environment? All of the you said you started in 2005, that the influx of social data has had to have changed your company somewhat. Can you talk a little bit about what the world of data analysis and insights looks like from when you started to now?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's really, you know, so started at Insight in 2005, started RJ Metrics in 2008. Okay. And having seen the universe change quite a bit since then, you know, some of the things that I think we've benefited from, and whether you can call it us having good long-term vision or us getting really lucky, is kind of up for debate. But, you know, some of the big trends that had to have really come to fruition in that time in order for us to have reached where we've reached have centered around just the advent of the cloud. And, you know, even in 2008, there certainly were, you know, Salesforce.com was an enormous company already by that point, and there were plenty of cloud-based or web-based businesses. But I think what had not happened in the mainstream was the level of comfort that people had with having their data that was, you know, more critical business data live outside of their internally hosted software. So, you know, in 2008, we would very often get the question, you know, what, when do you guys show up to install this on-premise software? They would want to know, you know, if the software was going off-site, you know, have very, very detailed, long discussions in and around the diligence of the security and kind of where that data was going. And fortunately, you know, security has been our number one priority from the get-go. So we've always had great answers to those questions and been able to make people comfortable. But what's been really interesting to see just as more of a macro trend is people have kind of stopped asking those questions. And we've obviously continued to focus on security as a top priority. But in the process of just having conversations with people about putting their data into this hosted service that's going to provide a lot of value, what's been really interesting to see is people's data is kind of increasingly already out there in the cloud in one way or another. And, you know, we do a lot of our hosting is done through Amazon Web Services. And the funny thing is that today, our number one data source that we pull from is Amazon Web Services. So the data is not even moving necessarily out of Amazon in the process of it going from, you know, our customers might have a website that's hosted on Amazon relational database store, and then it gets pulled into our EC2 servers, and everything's going from cloud to cloud. And that's a stark difference from even as recently as 2008, where even with these very small companies, they would have an expectation where, you know, they've got a dedicated web hosting provider somewhere that's hosting all their stuff, and they assume that we are either going to be installed on-premise there, or we are, you know, doing something a lot more complicated in order to get the data out and provide a level of comfort. And I think that that comfort has come, number one, from, you know, just an increase in the level of options for transferring data in a secure way through the advent of things like APIs that have just provided ways for us to query data that's a lot more generally accepted. And number two, just kind of the this very popular term, the cloud, which people like Microsoft have spent millions and millions of dollars publicizing over the course of the last 5 years. I mean, there have been Super Bowl commercials in the past couple of years around, you know, Microsoft saying, get in the cloud, get your data in the cloud. And that's them, you know, obviously making a motion toward consumers using the cloud to store their own information. And that's, you know, a response to Dropbox and you know, others representing a threat to some of these bigger companies. But big marketing dollars are getting spent making consumers comfortable with that idea. And because of that, I think it's trickled into the you know, even the lower level business user who's making a purchasing decision on an inexpensive piece of software like ours. And it's having a real impact on people's comfort level. So that's been, you know, one of many very interesting things to see.
Yeah. So the cloud has been obviously a huge impact across all businesses, how they function, whether or not you can work remotely, speed, flexibility, all that sort of stuff. And I think that, you know, the fact that we have these Amazon Web Services and things like that allow us to get into this thing that we're calling big data, because it would be tremendously expensive to host all of that data on site. So what I wanted to talk to you a little bit about was this idea of big data. It's the buzzword that, you know, to a certain extent makes me feel a little bit nauseous because it's so overused. But I realize that there's a lot implied in big data, and there's a lot of opportunity. And when you hear, you know, companies like IBM talking about smarter planets and using all of this, you know, massive amounts of data, this big data, to make smarter decisions, you know, it's fascinating. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, what you see as being considered big data, or the sort of things you've worked on that look like big data, and sort of as a, if you could work this in there, can you tell me what is like the, at what point does something cease becoming small data and become big data? Sort of like the small business and medium business and large business. You know, a lot of the people that would listen to this podcast might be in small and medium-sized businesses. So at what point are they able to take advantage of big data? At what point is their data considered a lot of data enough to be considered big data? You know, just talk a little bit about what the hell does all this stuff mean?
Yeah, absolutely. So I love this topic because I feel strongly about it. And I think that there's a lot of momentum in the media in and around the idea of big data that is very, very misguided or misplaced. My VP of marketing, like, kill me for saying this, but I would go so far as to say that none of our customers are actually big data customers. We are a big data business, but the reason we're a big data business is because in aggregate, we are servicing hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people with small data needs. And you know, my threshold for big data is very, very high, frankly, because the concept of taking advantage of some of these big data tools really starts to come into play now only when you have terabytes and terabytes and terabytes of data, which requires having a very, very, very large universe of information that extends far beyond just transactions or kind of the basic nuts and bolts that can be used to drastically improve the decisions you're making in an e-commerce business. So what I mean by that is really that you know, if you look at our customers, which are pretty much anybody that's selling up to $1 billion a year of things online, and you think about what that means in terms of data. Now, if you want to conduct an analysis like a cohort analysis on customer loyalty or a customer lifetime value analysis or, you know, run merchandising reporting to figure out, you know, which items lure in customers that are most likely to come in and make repeat purchases, for example, these are all analyses that are very common to customers of ours. But, you know, if you look at a website that's got an average order value of $100 and they sell $100 million a year, which makes them a pretty sizable online commerce provider, easily in the internet retailer top 500. You do the math on that, and you know, at one row in a database per transaction, that's only a million rows of data a year. Or even say that that $100 order translates to five items, and you've got an item level table. Okay, that's another 5 million rows of data a year. This volume of data that we're talking about is minuscule in the scope of what can be processed by some of the big data tools that exist out there today.
Let me just interject real quick, because I have a question about that. And I'm thinking about the amount of publicly available data, and as more and more data becomes generated by these sensors and the Internet of Everything, and there's just a tremendous amount of publicly available data. I'm even thinking of things like, you know, something as simple as the Forrester Social Technographics Profile tool that looks at different behaviors of different groups, or, you know, the Pew Internet studies that talk about people's behaviors. I look at things like that, and that's data that's not being generated by the company. But what happens when we start to see a world in which there's all of this data from all of these things that are creating it, and we can get in aggregate and we can bundle that data along with company data? At that point, does it begin to qualify in your mind to what becomes big data? Is big data the sort of thing that is going to be the product of everything being created and being available, or is it only something that you see being originated by a company? Do you get what I mean?
I get exactly what you mean. And I think the way that I like to think about it is around just the prioritization of the utility that you can get out of that data. And I think where I think we are today, and it's not where we're going to be forever, but I think where we are today and where we'll be in the immediate future is that our ability to collect and store data has vastly, vastly surpassed our ability to process that data in a way that actually drives us to action. So what's happening is that a lot of people are accumulating very, very high volumes of data. And we're building tools that are rather good at answering very specific questions that you might want to ask of those enormous data sets. So, you know, you can conduct a MapReduce process to give you an answer really rapidly as to how many people did X, Y, or Z within this social universe. But I think where the logic that exists in businesses that are trying to use this data to actually grow more quickly or be more effective at what they're setting out to do kind of falls short is in knowing what questions to ask. And I think that where sophistication has caught up a bit is, you know, if you look in the universe where we live, and you can take a look at these things that are directly correlated into some kind of revenue generation or profit generation or the acquisition of an incremental customer. A lot of this, even if you have access to billions and billions of engagement metrics and information on every single time every person has swiped a single thing inside of a mobile app, and you do the correlation analyses and you really dive in looking for these insights, the truth of the matter is that the vast, vast majority of companies out there, even when they have access to a lot of data, have not yet mastered their small data, let alone gotten themselves into a position where their big data is something that can be leveraged to, you know, represent the best use of their time in terms of making an investment in growing their business. So, you know, what we see in a lot of cases is that people who are sitting on these enormous kind of treasure troves of information about what their customers or other people are doing, you get under the hood a little bit and you realize that, you know, there's a minuscule fraction of a percentage of their data set that could be used to great effect, to have very, very drastic impacts on the performance of their business. And it's really after, you know, you've gotten to a Amazon or Walmart level of scale where you start to see these big data things that, indeed, if you figure out the right way to ask the questions, can, you know, move the needle by a few basis points, but those basis points represent tens or hundreds of millions of dollars at that scale. So I think that for the vast majority of people, particularly in the SMB universe, big data is very much a overinflated term. And when it really comes down to it, the idea of data in general as a driver of decisions is a lot more important than the idea of big data. And I think what we're able to really do as a business is help people wrap their heads around that and use this big data technology to answer questions that honestly, even the smallest pieces of their data can be really, really good at helping with.
Let's talk a little bit about small data then, because I'm totally with you. And I think in that entire answer that you just gave me, there's a whole bunch of jewels that I feel like I need to just run through and pull out as tweets or something, but just really a fabulous answer for it. And I want to talk a little bit about small data and aggregate data, because something I get particularly frustrated by is when I see these absolutely ridiculous reports about, like, you know, 3 a.m. is the worst time to post something on Facebook, or, you know, Instagram is the most valuable network. And it takes this aggregate data without any concern for the individual business needs, and it puts it out there and says, this is what it is. This is the best time to send an email. And I think that that's dangerous. So I'm, one, curious about your thoughts on aggregate data. The second piece that's related is as it relates to using small data and looking at each individual company, what are some things that you think the small and medium-sized business could do well to look at in their small data as it relates to content marketing or, you know, driving new leads or sales?
Yeah. So to hit your first point on aggregate data, I can certainly agree that on both of the points you're making, number one, which is that those reports make really great link bait. And to be honest with you, if you look at our blog, you'll probably find some cases where we are guilty of saying things exactly like that. I can remember a report that I did maybe a year or so ago where I analyzed all of the data from Hacker News, just kind of keeping an eye on posts that went up there historically and finding exactly those things. So what time of day is the best for getting your post up to the top of Hacker News, et cetera. And you're exactly right. I mean, I think the problem with those kinds of statistics are that, yeah, I'll click that link. I'd love to know what time of day is the best for me to post something to Hacker News. But at the end of the day, there are so many other factors that are playing a role there that it's really only a bit of icing on the cake. You know, if you happen to have something that's quality enough content to get upvoted to the number one slot on Hacker News, it was going to get upvoted pretty much whatever time of day you posted it. It's just a question of how many people are going to see it, how rapidly can it get posted up there, and what's the competitive landscape look like. But the reality is that, you know, you may slice that by an additional dimension and learn that that's really only the best time of day if you're going to be posting about a particular programming language. But the effect is so great on that particular topic that it overrides the entire average, even if the rest of them are worse. And I think that missing that next slice of data and kind of whatever categorization really holds that highest level of correlation underneath and shows the most dramatic effect can have a really drastic impact on how people react to data like that. And I think that actually feeds really well into your second question, because it's the same exact problem when you're running a business. And rather than saying, okay, this is the best time for me to post to Hacker News or post to Reddit if I want to get upvoted, it's the same question. This is the best time for me to send out a promotional campaign to my users. This is the best time for me to go and be advertising on Google AdWords or working with particular keywords. All of these things tie together, and the relationship that comes out time and time again is just that there are these aggregate statistics you can look at that can often help if you just base your decisions on them because of the law of averages and kind of mean reversion, but they're not always the smartest thing to do. So, you know, I think it was John Wanamaker's quote where he said, you know, I know that 50% of my marketing is working. And if I just knew which 50% it was, I could save a whole lot of money.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, you fall into that trap a lot, even when you have the data and you feel like, oh, the data is what's going to show me which of those 50% it is. It's really easy to get trapped inside of data and realize there's another one of those 50-50 splits. So, you know, you realize that, oh, this particular advertising channel is working a lot better than that one. So you funnel all your money into that advertising channel that's working better. And then you realize all of a sudden, oh, within this channel, only 50% of things are working well. And let's slice it by campaign. And then you find that winning campaign and say, oh, within this campaign, only 50% of the day parting times are working well. So let's slice it down into those days. And then you go into geography and et cetera, et cetera. And before you know it, you've gone down this rabbit hole and, you know, there's $20 of advertising inventory that you can spend. And you've kind of, you know, you've limited yourself in such a way that you've actually kind of put yourself into this analysis paralysis where you've taken away the, you know, you've hyper-optimized and taken away the kind of breadth of opportunity that might exist.
We're going to spend $20 on Sundays where it rains on this particular channel, but only during these two times, and we're only going to target it at male users. It's like, that'll work.
You know, you'll get 200% ROI, which is crazy, and then you can walk away with your $60 and call it a business. There's got to be a happy medium there, and I think that that's where it is very important in a lot of ways to not let. And I say this as the CEO of a company that's all about data-driven decisions, not just for us but for our customers as well. Not to let data be the only thing that is driving decisions in your company. I mean, I think that there's a really strong argument to be made for, the power of strategic vision and actually staying true to what you're setting out to do as a business. And I think that comes through in decisions about making investments on customer acquisition, about thoughts about branding, about product development, seeing a few steps ahead of where the data, which is often only showing you things that have happened in the past, are able to point. And I think that's a really powerful and important thing for anybody building a business today.
Absolutely. So that leads me into, you know, not getting data paralysis but at the same time using data to make smart decisions. You know, you look at your average small business or medium-sized business, and we're working with some pretty big companies that are still technically, I think, medium-sized businesses by number of employees or revenue, but they're still pretty big. And in that, they're using, you know, they have a website, they have a blog, maybe they're doing some email marketing, a little bit of Facebook, a little bit of LinkedIn. And, you know, we look at the data that's coming back, and so much of it seems unactionable. You know, how many likes you have, big deal, post engagement, things like that. And I recently wrote kind of a scathing post about engagement and how as a metric, it's fairly useless when we're looking at goals that represent leads and sales. When you're talking to a small business or a medium-sized business with a relatively small set of data, things like email opens and click-throughs and website visitors, what are some things that you would recommend to the small and medium-sized business to move the needle and do a little bit better with the data that they have?
Yeah, I think that my first step is always in and around instrumentation, and instrumentation with a specific goal, which is knowing not just when something happens, but who did it and if they've ever done anything before. And in a lot of cases, you know, this is potentially with a lead that is yet to become a customer or maybe even yet to become a registered user. But, you know, you can look at marketing automation platforms from HubSpot to Acton Software to Marketo and Pardot to, you know, people way more upmarket. And there are a lot of tools out there, and even Google Analytics does an okay job of this, where you can identify people, you can identify leads from visit to visit. And I think that what is really critical about that is the power of basically what amounts to cohort analysis in a whole lot of different contexts. So, cohort analysis is defined a lot of different ways, but, you know, the most broad way to put it is just the study of how different groups of people behave over time as it relates to interacting with your business. And the over time part's extremely important because all of your funnels, be they conversions from social into paying or from a visitor into someone who is socially engaged, into someone who's even more socially engaged, into someone who registers an account, into someone who puts some items in a cart, into someone who pays, into someone who comes back and pays again. Looking at that life cycle and understanding all those steps in the funnel really give you big opportunities to identify low-hanging fruit. And when you're a business that doesn't have a lot of data and that doesn't have a lot of opportunities to necessarily conduct A/B tests and get answers really quickly or take advantage of a lot of these really sophisticated optimization tools that get all the buzz, what you're really looking for is not these, you know, can I change the color of this button and it'll improve the performance of my conversion, my landing page by a couple of percent. You're looking for questions like, should I completely redesign the messaging around our brand, and will it lift conversions by 100%? You know, these are the questions you need to be asking, not just because your A/B test will take 6 months to run if the gap is only a few percentage points and you don't have a lot of traffic right now, but also because, you know, this is the time when you are kind of starting out as a business to ask these big fundamental strategic questions and not have enormous switching costs. You know, as big as the cost may seem of doing a pivot or doing something a lot more drastic than you had originally planned on the marketing side, as big as those may seem, you know, ultimately, once you make those moves, and we've made, you know, strategic moves like that many a time, you know, you realize how extremely valuable they are and how little the cost truly was. So, you know, if you look at the history of our website, for example, you know, you can go back on Internet Archive and you're not going to see a whole lot of very minor adjustments as to, you know, what the quote was on the homepage or what color the logo was. You're going to see big, drastic swings in the bat. And the reality is that, you know, we knew early on when we were not getting a huge amount of traffic that if we were going to test something, we were going to change something up, we were going to do it big, and we were either going to hit a home run with it or we were going to strike out. But, you know, getting a single or a double meant burning time. And even though that single or double might have improved conversion by a few percentage points, it also meant that we could have been doing something more drastic. And you know, in enough cases throughout our history, we've done something more drastic and really seen the amazing results from that and been able to really rapidly adjust. So I think that, you know, it all relates much more to a philosophy of kind of centering your goals around big, big, big wins that are going to have a major impact and ignoring things that look like they're ripe for minor optimizations. And I think that this relates back to the instrumentation and kind of looking at your funnels and your cohorts, because it's those major drop-offs in your funnel where you have those tremendous opportunities. I mean, if you look at, you know, even thinking about us throughout history, you know, there were periods in time when our funnel from free trial into paid, you know, we had, you know, something like 1 in 4 people would become paying customers, which sounds like a really high number. But if you looked at all the other steps in our funnel, they were much, much higher percentages. I mean, this was one where 3 out of 4 people get to this step and then don't continue. So we placed a lot more focus on how can we expose these people to our product in this particular stage to optimize this. And today, last month, in fact, 95% of people who entered our free trial ended up becoming paying customers. And that's a truly amazing number that we're really proud of. But it relates back to us having focus on a very specific piece of the funnel where we saw opportunity to more than double the number of full customers that were coming in any given month. And in reality, for us, it ends up having almost a quadrupling effect, because you take that funnel step that's rather drastic and plow your energy into there. And it becomes a rather obvious mathematical move to make. But sometimes it requires experimenting with things that aren't always extremely easy to quantify right off the bat. So I think being bold about picking big areas for improvement and going after them is really important.
And then there's the whole social aspect that comes after the fact and the word of mouth that's either measurable or immeasurable, whether or not it happens online or offline. So you get one additional person out of those 4, and, you know, say out of every 10 of those, 1 or 2 people is going to tell somebody else. It just continues to aggregate on itself.
Absolutely. And if you're lucky, you can track that in some way. And even if you can't, I think, you know, all these things have multiplying effects on one another. And the individual impact of those changes and those improvements are far greater than, or at least somewhat greater than, what you are measuring on an absolute basis.
Excellent. Well, Robert, this has been incredible. And before I let you go, I want to ask you one more question, and then I want you to tell people where they can go and be social with you.
Sure.
I want you to tell me a little bit about what you see as the challenges upcoming, either for your business, for the world of data analysis and companies using data. What's coming up that you see as a challenge that we need to prepare ourselves for, or at least be aware that it's coming?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we've been talking a lot about big data and the level of hype that it's receiving. And I think that in some ways we're in a little bit of a big data bubble in terms of the media and the investor community and you know, I don't think that it's unfounded. I think that there are going to be billions of dollars of economic value created over the next couple of years by businesses that are working in this universe. But I do also think that there's a lot of noise out there. And as you keep an eye out on, you know, on the headlines of TechCrunch and wherever else, and the, you know, every class of every incubator coming out, the universe of quote unquote analytics or data companies that are coming around the bend is growing in size. And I think that that can be a little bit dangerous just for an industry where I think it's very possible that you're going to have a lot of venture capital investors over the course of the next few years, and honestly over the course of the past few years, who put some money to work in a data analysis startup because there are so many out there that are going after such a promising industry and end up getting burned because not all these companies are going to make it out. And what I would hate to see is, you know, in the course of the next few years, this data, this big data bubble kind of having a little bit of a deflating or popping effect that's going to kill some of the enthusiasm and momentum around the amazing amount of progress that's being made in this space. You know, I don't think that, fortunately for us, I think we were a little ahead of the ball, and we've been able to get some really fantastic investors and frankly be an early mover in the space and capture up a lot of market. But I think it's good for us and it's good for all of the other companies out there working in the data universe right now that the media loves it and that we're getting a ton of attention. And I think that that's something that we can't count on always being there. So I think we want to be very careful about.
I totally get it. It totally resonates with me because, you know, what we're trying to work on in social business and really transforming the culture of companies and really embracing social technologies through and throughout is often tarnished by some of those people out there who just started a Twitter account and call themselves social media consultants. And all of a sudden, you know, the conversations we're having are about friends and followers and we want to talk business. So I can totally get that. You know, there's a lot of people out there that probably want to jump on the big data bandwagon and the data analysis bandwagon and data-driven decisions that may not know what they're doing or just, you know, by the nature of survival of the fittest may not make it out. So I can totally appreciate that. Tell people where they can be social with you, where they can find out more about RJ Metrics, more about you. You know, anything you want to let people know about at this point, and I'll be sure to put them in the show notes as well.
Awesome. Yeah. RJMetrics.com, first and foremost. We've got a 14-day free trial on our product. If you have any data whatsoever and you're trying to build a business online, definitely worth kicking the tires. You know, get your data in. We can set it up for free and, you know, hopefully get you in a position where you can be using your data to grow your business faster. Socially, we're on Twitter at RJMetrics. I personally am on Twitter at Robert J. Moore. And I think that's probably the best place to stay up to date with things I'm working on personally and the business as well.
All right. I'll put those all in the show notes for people. I encourage everybody to take a good look at the RJ Metrics tool. From what I've seen and from the growth of the company, it looks like you guys have the secret sauce. So I wish you all the success in the future. And hopefully we'll find a way to get some of our clients using it and making more data-driven decisions in 2014.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for the time, Jeff.
Cool, man. Thanks for being on.
Have a great one.
Take care, everyone.